Hello, and welcome to IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast, brought to you by Learning Essentials. Learning Essentials offers special education-based tutoring in your home by state-certified educators with advanced degrees in all areas of special education. IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast brings professionals together to educate and empower families navigating special education needs in the IEP process.
Welcome to the IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. Want more tips? Follow us on Instagram at Learning Essentials. I am excited to introduce our speaker today and our conversation today. I'm talking with Allison Edwards, talking about behavior has a purpose. And before I go ahead and introduce Allison, I know that she had quoted herself talking about behavior has a purpose, saying, "I see you, I hear you, I accept you, no matter what." I think that's incredibly empowering. Learning Essentials has this tagline, educate, experience, and empower. And I think it's very empowering for us to understand the purpose of a behavior and to send that message to our kiddos that we see them and we hear them and we accept them and we're ready to support them. So tons of tips I know Allison's going to share with us today. So with no further ado, I'm going to go ahead and introduce Allison Edwards is an LPC and RPT, is an affiliate professor in the Human Development Counseling Department at Vanderbilt University. The author of 5 books, Why Smart Kids Worry, Worry Says What, Marcy's Having All the Feels, 15-Minute Counseling Techniques That Work, What You Didn't Learn in Grad School, and Flooded, a brain-based guide to help children regulate emotions. Allison received her graduate degree in counseling from Vanderbilt University and is a nationally certified counselor, licensed professional counselor, and registered play therapist. Allison has over 20 years experience working as a school teacher, school counselor, child adolescent psychotherapist, and educational consultant to schools throughout the country. Allison travels both nationally and internationally, training parents and professionals in the area of empowering children, recognizing the social emotional needs of gifted students, and sharing how educators and parents can work together to meet the needs of anxious children. Allison helps parents understand how social-emotional differences can be supported both at home and school and provide consultation and staff development on how to effectively improve emotion regulation in the classroom. Welcome to IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast, Allison. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh my gosh, I'm very excited. And you have so many tips and information to share with us today. Let's start off our conversation talking about your recent book. Can you just kind of help? What is the flooded zone?
The flooded zone is the place that you get to in your brain when you can no longer think rationally. And it's something that we've all experienced, but know very little about. I didn't know about the flood zone until I met a friend of mine who was a psychiatrist who explained to me why we made such bad decisions as humans. And I thought it was fascinating and was so curious as why I'd never heard that information in all the years of training I had had as a counselor. And once I had the information, I just started teaching it to, you know, every kid that I met and all of the parents, and wanted them to understand that there is a time and a place in your brain and all of us where we should do something different than we have previously or in the other situation. And so it is a natural response, and it is the amygdala, which is the fear center of the brain. It is a response to protect us from danger. So it's a survival mode that has very good intentions, but doesn't go so well in everyday life.
Does it look different? Does the flooded zone look different from child to child or from circumstance to circumstance?
So what you do with the flooded reaction looks different. What happens biologically is not any different from kid to kid. So some kids, when flooded, will shut down. Other kids, when flooded, will lash out. So it can look different, but actually what happens in the brain is the same for everyone. The kids who shut down, you know, in schools or at home, you know, we can't get any information from. And often we want to get information. So we ask kids, what's wrong? And what can I do to help? And we get nothing because they're flooded. And when kids lash out, we usually try to give consequences to get them to rein it in. And that also doesn't work. So we're ineffective unless we understand what's happening. And that was the goal of the book, is to tell people, like, this is different than normal behavior. This is different than, you know, when you're flooded, we have to treat it as a special situation.
So what is the difference between the flooded zone and a temper tantrum?
So a temper tantrum is, you can often look at kids and when they look at you and kind of smile and keep doing something, that is not flooded. That is manipulation. And so when a child seems present enough to engage with you on a rational level, but also have this erratic behavior, that is a temper tantrum. When you can tell a child, I call it sort of being gone. You can tell, like, they're gone. And, you know, with my own kids and with kids I've worked with, I'm like, they're not even thinking it. And you get this in situations where, like, you give a consequence and the child will say, I don't care, take it all away. They will say, you know, and you know, that is not like, you know, that is not what they mean.
Right.
When parents get flooded, which we all do, we then say, fine, I'll take everything away. And we cancel plans. And then you're like, now I'm stuck because I've taken all this away. And now how do I was not supposed to give it back, but it was totally irrational. So I will say that, you know, this book was as much for children or as much for adults as it was for children, and helping us understand our own triggers and our own emotional reactions.
Are there warning signs that can be identified to help children before they enter the flood zone? So as an educator in a classroom, just kind of thinking through that lens, are there warning signs that we can kind of start to hone in on before they become flooded and then we've got a whole nother situation?
Yes. So if there are two types of triggers, there are internal triggers and there are external triggers. So internal triggers are thoughts that we have no idea about. You cannot predict those. So I will say, I get, you know, emails a lot from parents and educators that will say, I have no idea what happened. Those internal triggers are a lot harder to manage. But if a child has those, you can, you know, have a conversation about, hey, whatever it is, thought it is, if you can let me know when you have that thought, if you can catch it early, then we can come up with a plan. The external triggers are much easier because we know what those are. And so if you see a child that has a strong reaction to change, to, you know, failure, getting a bad grade on a test, to getting told on, like, you know, there's a lot of triggers. We all have those. And sometimes when we see a pattern, we can say, okay, I know this is a trigger. So I know what to put in place. Like, this child is going to become flooded. And those are much easier, as I said, because we can predict them. The internal triggers are much harder. But when you think about it, emotions on a number line, so 0 is no emotion and 10 is the worst. When you get to from an 8 to a 10, that is the flood zone. And so at that point, no conversation is going to be helpful. But if you can catch, you know, to me, 5 is a sweet spot because you feel discomfort, but you also have enough cognitive ability to do a tool or a strategy. So I like to teach kids number lines and say, hey, when you start feeling it, tell me. Now, some kids are so fast that it seems like, what? And so,
yes,
you know, this is not a... this is not a miracle cure. This is a understanding. And I will say, once you step back from a child you're working with or parenting and look at it, you're like, oh, and it's eye-opening, even, you know, for yourself and other people. But I am really, you know, talk a lot about patterns and, you know, what we're looking for. But a 5, if a child can say at a 5, hey, I'm getting flooded, or hey, I'm becoming overwhelmed, whatever, that's your time where you put things in place.
So when you talk about triggers and the internal and external triggers, is that kind of that thoughts, feelings, actions? I don't know if it's a triangle or circle in the counseling world, which one that is. Is that kind of that pattern? Like, just they have a thought and then that creates the feeling, but then creates the action. Is that similar or not similar?
It's somewhat similar. I like to think of it as the triggers create a negative emotional reaction. And so I'm more specific. So if you have a birthday party, you're going to be emotionally stimulated because it's your party. Now, as you know, most kids will get in trouble on the day of their birthday because it's too much. So it's like the people and the presents. And so they will have a complete meltdown and you know it's coming because it was just too much, right? So I like to think of the trigger as something that causes an emotional response that is extreme. And then what you do is you look at that and you figure out, like, first of all, is the trigger coming once a year on a birthday? Is it coming daily? So a trigger might be a math teacher every single morning. You can see a child even before they wake up in the morning. Maybe they go to bed with that trigger, the math teacher, the thought, and that's the trigger. And then what you do with that is, I like to think of it as, you then rate the feeling. So the trigger is my math teacher is mean, which is a common thing. You rate the feeling. How much do you feel that? I'm at a 5. Okay, let's do a strategy. The math teacher is mean. I'm at an 8. Okay, we're going for a walk. You distract, you do things like that. But it's a little bit, I mean, I think all of the, you know, sort of psycho or the social emotional education, when you talk about thoughts, feelings, and actions, it can all play a part in this. But what I think that is missing is intensity.
Yes.
This is all about intensity. So if you have a thought of, I don't like my math teacher, but you're at a 2.
It's fine.
It's another day. Who cares? Yeah. But this is what's different, is we're talking about intensity, and it's all about that, because we're always going to have triggers. And if you're a 5 or even get up to 7, you can manage it. But we're talking about the emotional intensity. That's where we're getting into problems.
And what a life skill to be able to identify that, to have a conversation and to learn strategies, because it may be the math teacher today, but it's going to be your coworker, your boss, your friend, as you get out into the real world as an adult. So if a child's on the cusp of entering the flooded zone, what are some techniques for kind of reeling them back in before that tipping point, before that 8 hits?
So I think breathing, if a child will focus on doing breathing, it's fantastic. Kids sometimes do not want to do this. They find that, you know, anxiety is a very keyed up emotion and breathing is a slowdown. And so sometimes kids who are keyed up, they can't get to that place. So if they are kind of one of those more active kids, I like using change the channel, which means that you can change the thought to something else. And the way I describe this is, your brain is like a television and you have the remote and you choose the channel you want to think about. And so again, this is very different from CBT, sort of like thought replacement, because you want to choose something that's the same intensity of the negative thought. So a lot of times, you know, you'll choose a thought like, oh, my math teacher is actually nice. Well, that, you don't believe that. So you want to change it to have nothing to do with the math teacher. When I get home, I get ice cream. So big change the channel. So those are two of the most common. Are square breathing, which is a breathing exercise, and change the channel. There are a lot of other, especially, you know, getting kids the energy out, having kids, you know, get all of the extra energy, excess energy out too, that you can use. But most kids will tell you what works and what doesn't. And they will say, nope, like breathing, I'm not doing that. Okay, well, let's try change the channel.
That is fantastic. And I was just thinking, even with working with kiddos in the realm of education and educational therapy, and I'm always, you know, they'll tell you what strategy is working, what's not. So you're 100% on with that. I was giggling when I think change the channel is really a phenomenal phrase, but internally giggling. I have 3 boys, and oftentimes as they're kind of negotiating or talking or something happen, I'll say to one, you're not in this episode. So just kind of related to like a changing of the channel. I know it's a different concept, but inside it just kind of made me think of that. So how does the brain interact with emotions?
The brain is the brain is the hub of emotion, everything. The brain is the hub of everything. So the brain's job is survival. And so it is, when you think about, you know, all the things that the brain does, the brain is here to keep us alive. And so what's interesting is that while our world has advanced, our brain has not when it comes to basic survival. And that I don't think will ever change, because that's the primary goal is survival. And so our brain is going to pick up things that come in that are dangerous. And so that used to be, if you were in a cave and you heard a noise outside, your brain would wake you up and say, go check, right? Because you're someone's with a club and could hit you and kill you. So now we have alarms and dogs and police officers, and we wake up in the middle of the night and we have the same reaction as if we were in a cave. So the brain is here for survival. And because we don't have the same fears anymore, our brain will pick up a math teacher or a test as being exposed in the middle of the night with a club. The brain does not know the difference. And so the reaction is to protect yourself. And so when you get anxiety or even, you know, any of the depression, that the lower level sort of, I call it negative thinking, it's because your brain doesn't want you to be too comfortable, because then you're not ready for the danger. And so the brain is constantly working to protect us. And so what happens is all the higher level functioning is at the top of the brain. And so that's emotion regulation, that is, you know, rational thinking, and that's very top brain. And so you will see that that develops pretty early. And we now know from neuroplasticity that we're sort of always changing. So that is the kind of the part of the brain that can change. The bottom of the brain is the primal brain, and that is where the amygdala is, which is the fear center. And so they're working, they're two opposite places, and the amygdala will fire. And when that happens, the blood all rushes from the top of the brain to the amygdala to help. And that is just fight or flight. So all the, it doesn't matter what you think about it. If there's someone outside your cave with a club, run or fight. And so what happens is you lose rational thinking and you lose emotion regulation because the blood goes to the amygdala. And what's so interesting that I found is that the body, the brain is always sending blood different places for healing. And so I was an athlete and I learned early on that ligaments heal slower than muscles. And if I tore a ligament, I was looking at double the time because ligaments don't get blood. And I was like, that's fascinating. Muscles get blood. Well, it's all about blood flow. And so if you don't have blood at the top of your brain, you are not a rational person. So the brain is, it's all working to help you, but it doesn't help you be a functioning person. I like to say that an anxious person has an overactive amygdala. So there's very little blood at the top of the brain. Kids who've experienced trauma and even adults, they act as if they are constantly in fear. And so the brain is, you know, studying counseling and psychology, it was all about thoughts and feelings and so little about biology. And I thought, wow, we're really missing the mark here. If you've ever seen a kid or felt physically out of control, like you had so much rage, or you know, we've all experienced these times where your like body is shaking. That is not thoughts and feelings. That is biology. And so, you know, this you know, angle is hopefully going to help people understand that some of this is just beyond our control. Like we know there are things we can do, but also giving ourselves a little grace and saying, yeah, like it's okay to be flooded. You know, I think sometimes want to be these like very, these people who are always in control and they make the best decisions and, you know, but also say like, yeah, I feel very out of control sometimes. I may not lash out at people, but to feel it is very natural. You know, the brain is constantly sending messages. And so paying attention to those, I think, is very important. But the brain is the hub. And that's why so I hope that that kids learn this in like psychology 101 or even just like life 101, like how to be a person who can regulate emotions. I think we need that class in high school, like before you graduate, you know?
100% life skills class, 100%. And then there's some kids that are just set up either just externally or internally to be sensitive to those sight sounds and, you know, just the sensory input, which I'm sure puts those emotions on high alert even more than others.
Mm-hmm.
And so what terms should parents be cautious of using when discussing emotions with their kiddo? Or are there any terms?
Well, I think that saying good and bad emotions it's not helpful. I'm really shocked by the number of parents that still think that anger is a choice. Feelings are not choices. Behaviors are choices. We cannot choose feelings. And that to me, when I sort of...
Allison, say that again for folks that are listening. I think that's incredibly important.
Feelings are not choices. Actions are choices. And so the way you feel about something is not your choice. So if you're a parent, this is a very common thing. A parent spends a whole day with a child and the child comes home and says, I'm sad because I feel like you never spend time with me. And a parent is immediately frustrated. I've spent my whole day with you and now you feel like I don't spend time with you. And that is wrong because look at the facts. And so you get into this discussion with your child, this argument. And the reality is, if that's how you feel, that is how you feel. And if we would acknowledge feelings and say, I understand that and that I totally validate that. The feelings are, we want to have children feel, whatever they have, don't be afraid of it. Like, befriend your feelings. Now the actions we can work on. And the actions are, did you lash out? Did you say a hurtful word? Did you, hit somebody? Did you, whatever it is. But the feelings are always fine. And that's, I think, the message we want with, when I wrote the book, Marcy's Having All the Feels, I wanted kids to see like all of them matter. That's what makes our lives colorful. And parents sometimes will say, I just want my kid to be happy. And I'm like, that is the wrong goal. A better goal is I want my children to be able to manage discomfort.
Yes, yes.
Because life is filled with discomfort. And if we accommodate children so that they try to feel happy, we do not help them prepare for the road, which the road is difficult. So we want children to feel discomfort and manage it. And to me, that's the best indicator of success is managing discomfort and feeling it, but being able to say, yeah, okay, I can do this. Like, I don't like the feeling. I feel sad. I feel angry, but I can manage it. And that's where I think the number of, when you look at older children's suicide and self-harm, the numbers are, I can't believe the number of kids, but I think one of our big problems as society is that we've accommodated so much that children don't know how to manage discomfort. And when they get a bad grade on a test, they say, I want to kill myself. Which is like, whoa, that's a huge reaction, but it's the discomfort of the grade or it's the discomfort of loss of a friend group that they can't manage. So we have to help children manage that.
If children have difficulty processing emotions or managing emotions, are there cognitive interventions that you suggest or there strategies that you suggest to kind of help them with this process?
I think the first step is just to give them information. Like I like to say like emotions 101. And say, these are all the feelings that, you can have. You can even create some. Like kids like to say meh as a feeling. Like, I feel meh, And I'm like, okay. Right. So kids love to come up with their own feelings. But let's talk about all the feelings. And then let's talk about all of the reactions we can have to those. And just to let them know. And then talk about strategies. I'm actually launching a product company that's going to be hopefully launched in the next couple of months, which has the first product is going to have feeling cards that has 20 different feelings. And so kids could identify the feeling. And on the back of each card is a strategy to manage the feeling. And so it's going to help kids from ages 3 and up learn how do you manage the feelings? Because even excited can lead to trouble, right? You're excited as a 10 and you jump up and you scream and yell. And now you're, like getting a note home to your parent that you can't sit down in class. So, talking about all of the feelings and then just saying, the strategies. And so there are a number of strategies and you can never start too early. But I think sometimes we rush to the strategy instead of understanding the first part, which is how are you feeling? You acknowledge the feeling. You're saying, doesn't matter what that feeling is, it's okay. And then what is the number from 1 to 10? And now we determine a strategy, because if you're a 9, strategies don't work. So where are you now? Oh, I'm a 3. Okay, here's a number of strategies you can use. So it's a different system than, oh, you're angry, here, do some bubble breathing. Well, often we don't even ask the child how they feel. We just say, you seem angry, do this. Well, we have to get buy-in. The most important thing is for the child to acknowledge the feeling. And so as a counselor, I remember at a session years ago, a kid came into me and the teacher had said, you know, I was a school counselor and a teacher had said, this child has anger problems. So I got the note and child came in and I said, so you're angry and let's do some strategies. And so, you know, I was teaching, you know, I did a clay pummel. We talked about ways to release anger. And towards the end of the session, the child says, I'm not angry. And I said, what? And he said, I'm not angry at all. Actually, the teacher thinks I'm angry. I don't really like her, but I remember thinking, I didn't even ask you. I just took the note, assumed. And so many times as adults, we get it wrong because we're saying, this is your problem. This is the solution. And so what I'm trying to do is get kids to buy in. Here's my feeling.
Well, then they have control, right? Because then they're able to say, this is where I am on the spectrum of feelings. And then here, and then you can provide as an adult, here's some choices of what to do. And then they can choose which one works for them. So there's an element of kind of ownership there, right? To be able to have that dialogue back and forth with the kid.
This is their journey. And so as parents and educators and counselors, we get sort of worked up or want to help whenever we see kids doing something that's disrupting their lives or ours. Mm-hmm. And so this is a common problem. A parent will say, my child is disrespectful. They're out of control. They don't listen. They don't follow the rules. And so I want you to teach them strategies on controlling themselves. There is no buy-in from a child on that. So when I meet with a child and I'll say, what's going on at home? And usually the child will say something like, well, my sister gets all of the attention. She's the favorite. And so that is the child's problem, is the only way I get attention is when I act out. So if I look at this and say, okay, let's talk about how to control your behavior, the child has no buy-in. And if a child controls their behavior, they'll never get attention. So I have to step back and say, hold on. We have to rework this so that we shift the parenting lens here of like, I call it catch them being good.
Yeah.
When can I see my child and praise my child? And then that the behavior is gone. We don't even need the strategy. So sometimes kids are so smart, they are going to do whatever gets the attention that they want. And often that is the squeaky wheel, right? So you find a way. Like, I'd rather have bad attention or negative attention than no attention. So when I see the most buy-in is when a child is anxious, because that feeling, most kids want it to go away and they will do almost anything to make it go away. So I have specialized in anxious children for 20 years. And most of them, when they show up, they say, I need help. Tell me what to do. I'll do it. And interestingly enough, like that, if they come in and they're eager and they do strategies, their life looks completely different within, you know, a couple of months, because they understand it and they're motivated. A kid who's depressed is less motivated because there's more of a lethargic nature. Mm-hmm. And then a kid whose parents think they have a problem are the least least likely to be motivated. They're like, actually, my parent needs the therapist, which,
yeah.
Yeah, we all need therapy at some point.
Maybe.
Yeah,
maybe. Right. So what causes children who are advanced to have that deep worry or that anxiety?
So this is very common. It's really what really has to do with is development. And so it's asynchronous development is what happens or the cause of it. So children who, as they develop, usually there's three areas of development. There's physical, there's emotional, and there's intellectual. And so I was trained as a teacher and early in my career, and they, you know, one of the professors at some point said, I'm teaching you, if you're a second grade teacher, I'm teaching you to teach kids who look, act, and think like second graders. And so you're able to, you know, you look, you know, you're about the same size. You can do the skills, like you could, you know, do the work in class, and you can keep your hands to yourself and be polite. So what happens is, when a child, one of those areas is off or it's asynchronous, that becomes a problem. So physically, a pediatrician, there might be an issue, the physical problem a pediatrician looks at. The teacher would look at the intellectual development. And then counselors and parents, we all have to deal with the emotional piece. What happens with smart kids is they may look like a second grader, but think like a fifth grader. And the problem is they aren't emotionally able to process what they're thinking about. And so I have a number of kids in elementary school who are worried about the Delta variant of COVID. And they are already trying to process the fact that their parents have the vaccine, but what if the vaccine doesn't work? And what if this never gets better? And I'm like, you know, as the adult saying, whoa, like that's interesting information. Like they've picked up all this information and they've put it together, but they can't process that.
Yeah.
What you'll often see with children who are intellectually gifted or advanced, they have lower emotional development because the brain has this way of working itself out. And so there's always a balance. And so often very intelligent people are emotionally not as advanced because those two things work. They're not in the same part of the brain. And so it's, you know, kids who are bright or intellectually gifted are twice as likely to have social emotional problems. So you get, yeah, you know all the answers in class, but you don't know how to play at recess is a typical situation. So that asynchronous development is what causes children to understand concepts that they can't emotionally process. And so our job is to boost emotional intelligence because they will keep getting smarter.
So how can we help our gifted children navigate these big feelings or their big feelings?
Well, I think first of all, acknowledging the feeling and saying, I understand you're scared. I understand you're afraid. So one of the things we usually do is say, don't worry about that because here's all the facts. The chances of you getting the Delta variant are very low. You know, so you kind of go through the facts, and that's not helpful. So what we do is we help children acknowledge the feeling, and then we teach them strategies. We go to the feeling and we stay off of the surface, which is the problem. So too often we talk about the problem instead of saying, I see you're afraid. Let's do a strategy. We try to rationalize with this, and you cannot rationalize with an irrational person, and anxious people aren't rational. So it's so simple, but so hard, right?
It's complex because then your feelings get in the way, right? As an adult, you see your baby or your student struggling. And as an adult, you want to kind of step in and solve it. And what I have learned, and I don't know if it goes along with this or not, is to just say, you know, are you sharing this with me or do you want help with this? To kind of just differentiate, but then I think also, like you're saying, is acknowledge those feelings. And it's, for a parent, it's a challenge, right?
The worst challenge is to be a kid and have these big thoughts that you can't do anything about.
Yeah, powerless.
Death is the worst. I call them default worries. And these are the worries that we can never resolve. And so our brain has a lot of energy, especially if you're bright. There's so much excess energy. School will never take all of that. And so you're sitting in class, you already know how to do it, and your mind's going. And so you get on a default worry that you can't resolve, and you spend this extra energy. And so what happens is you're in this rabbit hole and you can't get out of it. And then you have all these feelings of panic. And so when a child does that, you know, you say, okay, what is the feeling? And you go back, it's the same structure. If it's death, if it's global warming, if it's COVID, if it's what am I going to, you know, I had a child recently tell me they're going to be a failure, even though they're, you know, straight A's and they're going to be a failure in life. It's like, wow. So stay off the surface, because once you feel like you've come up with the perfect answer, they're going to have a new problem. So you go to the feeling. And so with anxiety, which a lot of children who are bright have, you constantly go back to, I'm worried about this, to this number. And here's a strategy I can use, because there will always be another worry. So stay off the surface. That's my suggestion.
Go below it.
So as a parent, at what point should they seek additional help?
So I talk about the, when I look at this, I look at the three areas of a child's life. And so I call it the rule of three. But when I'm determining or helping parents determine, like, what is the best avenue or what's the best direction to go, I look at it, you know, there's three areas of a child's life. There's home, school, and friends. And if one of those areas is affected by, say, anxiety or some emotional, you know, issue, then you can, if one area is affected, say that, you know, they're anxious at school, but they're home, they're great, they're calm, they're happy, they're friends, they have great, you know, neighborhood kids to play with, then I would say you can read a book, you can talk to a friend, you may, you know, reach out to the school counselor, say, hey, can you check on this? If there's two areas, so say a child is anxious at school, and the second they get in the car, they start talking about their fears and it goes on all night and they have trouble sleeping and then they wake up in the morning and it continues, at that point, I say you need to get additional help. So I would go at that point to an outside counselor or seek resources outside of a school. You know, children are like onions, and as they're born and they grow, they just keep adding layers. And what you don't want to do is let these layers, as I was a child who was anxious, who never got help, which is what I, why I'm doing this as a career, because by the time I finally got help, I had all these layers that I had to peel back and all these behavior patterns that were not serving me because I didn't get help. So early intervention is best. So two areas, you're saying, we're going to take our child to a counselor, we're going to get help. You can also think about this. I'm going to talk to the pediatrician about this. So this could be somewhere, the counselor or the pediatrician. And then three areas, I think you need to take that very seriously. When parents say, you know, yeah, she's, you know, my child's anxious and they struggle at school and at home and their friends, it's affecting their friends. I say, imagine that you were having marital problems, that you had just moved to a new city and you were away from your friends, right? Like, imagine, and then you also hated your job. Like, what is sustaining you? And so with kids, we just keep saying they're going to be fine. But when you look at what's sustaining them, a lot of kids that by the time they get to me, they're drowning. They've had those three areas. And it's like being in a tsunami without a life raft. You're just, and by the time they get to me, they're so far in a hole that we have to dig out with just, you know. So I will tell parents, if there are two areas, talk to the pediatrician, find an outside counselor, get help. And the outcome is so much better than if you wait and think it's going to get better.
So how does puberty and hormones play a role in the bigger emotions, the flooded zone? And with that, how can parents help navigate those kind of tumultuous years?
Yeah, those are tough years. I think, first of all, just thinking of middle school being a really hard time, just being prepared for that. Just get ready. Nobody likes it. And if you
hold on tight.
Yeah, if you have expectations of actually, we're really, you know, this, we think it's going to be different. It's probably not. It's a very hard time for many reasons. I would think the first thing is just to prepare yourself and know it's coming and to give your child a little more grace during these times, because there's so much happening physically and emotionally that they often have no idea. Like, kids are, they don't know either. I mean, they say irrational things and they're just, you know, I remember working at a middle school thinking, what is happening? Like, I mean, and they're all growing at different rates too. And so some are in puberty, some are like not, voices are changing. It's, so I would say that that time, that period of time, you know, is a real, it's really difficult for them, and to think of a parent with some empathy of like, this is really hard. And then also, so elementary school is very black and white in terms of rules, because kids are black and white thinkers. In middle school, it becomes gray. And so you're going to have to parent differently. So the harsh, if you do this, you're going to get this, doesn't work in middle school. You've got to be more creative. And with a bright child, you have to do that in elementary school anyway. You're already used to that. But I think sometimes as parents, you have these rules and you say, okay, you know, if you do this, I've always done it this way. If you, you know, have your phone past 10 o'clock, you lose it for a week. Well, that is not an appropriate middle school response, because middle school is all about social connection. And so I think you have to rethink about parenting in more of the gray area of, I'm going to like think about this consequence rather than just giving it out to an elementary age student. You would do that. Middle school, you've got to be a little more creative. One of the things that I think is important is that by sophomore year, a lot of this should be ironed out because college is coming or out of high school, whatever post high school is. And so I will see kids who went through, I would call like a hormonal kind of rebellious time, but they're a junior in high school. And I'm like, this has gone on too long, because by sophomore, you're trying to prepare your child. Okay, you're going to be on your own soon. Yep. So then I like to say that you go from a manager to a consultant.
Yep.
You move into the role of, hey, you're going to be on your own soon. I'm here to help you and support you, but I'm not going to manage your day. And so I think when a child is hormonal and emotional, the worst thing you can do is become more of a manager.
Yeah.
You want them to go through some of this on their own and be supported, but not also a lot of times you know, kids will stop caring about school. They'll, you know, become rebellious, be really short with you. And if you have the same hard lines, you're going to lose the connection. So throughout adolescence, my focus is remain connected to your child. Even if it means, yeah, I probably shouldn't have let him do that. I did. Okay. But you know what? We had a good conversation. You know, it's, those are more meaningful than I said, you cannot, whatever, do this thing.
So let me ask you, because we've talked a lot about parents, right? And because you were a former classroom educator, how can we translate this for educators that they could implement into their classroom environment and community to help students make the environment less stressful for our learners and or help the kiddos identify when they're flooded and taking that time? Like, what could they do through an educator's lens, as you know, especially now and starting in the fall, hopefully everybody's going to be back into the groove of a classroom or that more traditional classroom.
Yeah. I think at this point, especially like, you know, before you even the school year starts, is thinking about how to set up your space to help children regulate emotions. And that is something that if you do that as an educator, you're going to have a much better year. And so when you are flooded, the way to reset your brain is to change the five senses. And so one thing as a teacher that I always had is when you walked in my room, there would be three senses that would change by just walking in my classroom. And so you walked in my room every morning. I had classical music playing. I don't like classical music, by the way, but it was different. The kids didn't really hear it at home and it set a tone. They walked in, they heard something different. I always burned lavender oil because we couldn't have candles. And I just, you know, especially kids coming in, you know, kids don't take showers, lots of smells. It was for me more than, you know, but they walked in and they smelled something different. And then when they come in and they saw something different. And so I tried to have something in my classrooms, you know, positive words, things that were posted so that when they came in, it kind of woke them up to the space they're in. So even before a kid walks in your classroom, having these things that you are creating for them so that when they come in, it sets a different tone. And I would have kids come in my classroom and say, it smells like your class. It sounds like your class. And so it resets their brain. So that would be first. I think also talking to kids, you know, being prepared, you know, looking at kids' records, being prepared for, you know, the kids that might have emotional difficulties and being ready, and, you know, for those kids and to have conversations with them and say, hey, you know, I know that, you know, you might be angry or frustrated or sad when these things happen. Let's talk about strategies. And so with kids who get flooded easily, there should always be an out for them. And so it's a prearranged situation where you explain to a child, like when you're flooded, you need to reset your brain. And here are the things you can do in our school. So say that a child, you know, it's a time for a test and they are flooded. You set the test down and they're gone. So the worst thing you can do is have a child push through that.
Yeah.
So the child would know, I'm going to get up and I'm going to walk to the bathroom and I'm going to feel something different. I'm going to run cool water on my hands. I'm going to see something different. I'm going to see the hallway and I'm going to hear something different. I'm going to hear the kids moving in the classroom. So that would be an agreed 5 minutes to reset your brain. And then you come back. And when there's this arrangement, kids can get into this, like they come back 5 minutes later and they're better.
When I like how you added, like, you're going to see something different, hear something different, smell, like just kind of trying to, then they kind of almost have a step process, a step by step, not just I'm going to go to the bathroom, but I'm going to feel something. And this is what that is. I'm going to hear something. This is, so they can really kind of pave that out ahead of time, which I would imagine would set them up for greater success.
It does. The oftentimes too. So a cool drink of water, I'm going to taste, it kind of wakes you up. So on a cold day, if you're flooded, the best thing you can do is step outside the school, because it, all of your senses, that cold air, and you kind of, it just, it, this is biology, not psychology. So it wakes you up. And so having this arrangement with kids is actually, it's great. And it prepares them. I have kids that they have lavender oil on a bandana in their desk or in their pocket. And if they need to reset, they go. And if you put that on your nose, it wakes you up. And so they also have like a little mini tin of Altoids. When they go in the hallway, they put an Altoid in, a mint.
Yeah.
And it resets your brain. So in chapter three of Flooded, the whole chapter is on what you can do in a classroom to help promote emotional regulation. And so if you set it up and then you have a communication, usually kids feel very safe, and safer they can feel in your classroom, the better they will behave.
Amen. 100%.
When I was a teacher, they had this rule that my supervising teacher said, don't smile till Christmas. That's what she taught me. And I remember being a teacher and thinking that is so ineffective because you're scaring children. And you think that if I scare you enough, you're going to follow the rules. Instead of coming in this with, hey, I'm going to try to connect with you.
Yeah.
Year goes so much better. So for those teachers out there who are don't smile to Christmas, I would encourage you to try a different approach if there are any left, because it creates this divide. And children who don't feel safe are not, if they don't think you care about them, they're going to make your year very difficult.
It's true. And they feel secure, and it's almost this loyalty. I taught juvenile delinquents at some point in my career and in high school. And so I'd have the same students, or, you know, some of them year to year, and they felt connected, they felt safe. And then when you'd have new students come in, it was just, they kind of help set the tone, because they knew that there was a balance. They knew that you were fair, that you were consistent. It was predictable, which is huge. It's huge for kids to just feel that security and to understand this is how things are going to look. Again, kind of back to what you're saying, they have that predictability of, I'm going to feel this, I'm going to see this, I know what's going to happen. And that internally is going to reduce that anxiety to make them more available for learning. So what is the most important emotion we can help children understand and work through?
So I think that anger is the most confused. We're most confused by anger. I think understanding that anger is the top and what's beneath it is more important. And so I think when you look at children who, you know, children will say, I just have a lot of anger. Most of that comes from feeling embarrassed, feeling judged, feeling insecure. All of that comes out as anger. And so to me, anger is it is the emotion we need to spend some time on, and not anger management, but saying like, what is beneath it? Most kids who lash out are extremely sensitive, and they protect this very sensitive place. And so if we can get to that sensitive place, that to me changes. If you look at the number of disciplinary referrals and, you know, suspensions, it's all coming from anger. And if we can go into most of the anxiety, even though it's prevalent, those kids are more sit, try to deal with it. Anger is what gets you in trouble and is what causes the most consequence. But if we look to what is the feeling beneath that, to me, that's the thing I think is the most important is what was, go beneath the anger, what happened? And usually you get to these more subtle feelings that kids can't manage. But the anger comes out, and it's actually the most accepted, especially for boys, the most accepted emotion. You can be angry, but you shouldn't be sad.
Yeah.
That's weakness. Anger is totally fine. And as you see, anger leads to nothing but trouble in life. Especially, you know, little kids, they hit, and then later that's assault. I mean, you get early on, how do you manage these big emotions? So I would say anger is the one that we need to really look at the most and look beneath it. And that, to me, the triggers are really important when you look at anger, like what caused this? And most of the time it's nothing. It's always some sort of sensitive place. And it comes out as self-protection.
Kind of teaching them to identify that before it comes out.
And to get the need met, you know, yeah. If there's a need there, there's a huge need. And what is that need? And how can we meet that need? And kids that I've worked with that have had the most anger have, there's this unmet need. And when they get it met, it dissolves. So much of this is just diffused because they're like, oh, I'm getting that need met. And
what a relief, right? What a relief for that.
And it's a lot simpler than, you know, as an educator, I would have to do functional behavioral assessments with kids. And, you know, you take a kid and you're like, okay, and you have all these behaviors and you're doing all these numbers. At the end of the day, say, asking a teacher, do you like this kid? Like, that's a pretty good starting point.
Yeah.
Does this kid have any friends? Like, let's go to, like, instead of writing a bunch of numbers down, let's just ask sort of basic questions. Like, is this kid, do you like this kid? Do you have a good relationship? And it's funny when I've asked those questions, teachers are like, what? And I'm like, look, we may not need the functional behavioral assessment. If we'll get to sort of this root issue is what is your relationship with this child? And then let's work from there. But, you know, sometimes in education, we're so problem focused. And even in our world, let's fix the problem instead of saying what caused the problem. And I think we need to do better about that is looking for the roots and the sources.
Your approach is incredible. It seems so simple and basic, but so powerful. It's just, you know, I mean, what a tool for our kids to then grow and be into adults that are productive and engaging and understand the world around them. I mean, it's just been such a pleasure. I could sit here and talk to you and for much longer. Is there anything that I didn't know enough to ask that I didn't ask? Is there any kind of final thought that you would want to share?
I think I would like to just leave on saying that, you know, we have a unique opportunity to help children while they're young. And I think, you know, as a society, if we make that a priority, I think we're going to see a very different future. And I think there is a mental health crisis and that a different approach while children are young can change that. And I think we can do better. And there are so many resources to do that. It's a shift in thinking. And so I think people who are educators and counselors and parents, we're all in, you know, we want the best for our kids. And to make emotions a priority in the home is what I would leave. It's just make it as important as academics, as important as any basic need, is teaching them emotional development and emotional exposure is just as important as anything else we do. And so that's what I would say.
100%. If you could have a billboard with one tip for parents, what would it be and why?
Stop talking.
Fantastic response. And why do you say that?
Because we talked, it stop talking. Because we need to start listening and we need to start understanding. And I find myself with my own kids explaining things they already know. And as parents, being curious and listening to their worlds. And we get it wrong so many times and we think that's the problem. And then a child's like, actually, no, that isn't. And so I think stop talking is some advice we could all take. Stop talking, you know. Start listening, start, you know, connecting, but stop talking.
Amazing. Amazing. Allison, how can people find you? How can they find more information? How can they go out? I encourage them to purchase your books. How can they access you, find you?
So my website is AllisonJEdwards.com. And that is sort of the hub of, you know, the information about books. My new feelings products will be coming out in a couple of months and it will be on there. On Instagram, the social media outlet I use the most. And my username is Allison E L P C. And I can also send those over to you and you can give those to the listeners. But yeah, I think just, you know, the website's probably the easiest. And then the books, I have a new book coming out that's called How to Crack Your Peanut. And that is for children to understand how to manage emotions with the amygdala. So the amygdala actually looks like a peanut. And so the book, it teaches kids how. So it's basically flooded for children. And that's going to be coming out in the next couple of months. So I'm really excited about that.
Yeah.
It's great for us to know, but I want kids to know how to manage this. And so the book is a story about a kid who can't manage emotions and just learning how to do that on a developmentally, you know, appropriate level. So I'm really excited about How to Crack Your Peanut. I think maybe I need to make one for adults, a cartoon. How do we crack our peanut? So that's coming out. So the two things, all the feels, feeling cards, I'm very excited about, and How to Crack Your Peanut will be out soon as well. So
I can't wait. Again, this is IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast. I am your host, Wendy Taylor, and our conversation today was with Allison Edwards, Behavior Has a Purpose. And if you want more tips, come follow me on Instagram at Learning Essentials, and looking forward to our next podcast.
Thank you for joining us today for our IEP Essentials Pro Tips podcast. To hear more pro tips and find additional IEP Essentials, including our IEP webinar, please visit www.learningessentialsedu.com.